on energy momentum as usual, I guess with an I in here. So I don't care about the factors. But now there's a possibility consistent with associativity or the graded Jacobi identity of another, usually this commutator is zero, but now we can have something which is a singlet under spins, which would be anti-symmetric. The whole thing has to be symmetrized, so I'd have to have it anti-symmetrized in I and J times some other scalar generator, which could be allowed. So this is like a U1 charge. It's a conserved charge, and from associativity of the algebra, you need that it commutes with all the other charges. It's a scalar, so of course it commutes with Lorentz rotations, but also with translations and the supercharges. So it commutes, so it's a central element of the algebra, so it's called a central charge. Okay? It's part of the n equals 2 algebra. So let's understand what it means to have a central charge in an algebra. The main thing is that it gives rise to a bound on the mass of any state. And the bound is that if you have a state of mass m, that mass has to be greater than or equal to the value of its central charge. So how do we say that? Well, we can be more precise about that by saying since the energy momentum and z commute, I can certainly go to a basis of my Hilbert space, which diagonalizes both, right? So in other words, I'm going to discuss my state, and I can choose it to be eigenstates of the central charge and of energy momentum. Let's say it's a massive particle. Let me boost to the frame in which it's at rest so we go to the frame where p mu is m 0, 0, 0, and z is z, right? And so we get some algebra. You could write it down now. And now you can just do some manipulations on this algebra. I'm not going to go through them, but they're pretty straightforward. And you can write it in the algebra in the following form. These C's are just some linear combinations of the components of the Q's and the Q bars. Okay. I'll tell A and B is just some index. And let's see. And the algebra can be rewritten in the following form. And I guess another set, C twiddle. This is supposed to be M, the mass, minus the norm of this central charge. This can be a complex number, or it's really, yeah. And the rest of the anti-commutators of the C's are zero. Okay, this should remind you a lot of what you did to find the particle representations of the supersymmetry algebra. You went to the rest frame, and then you showed that the Q's or certain combinations of them could be considered as fermionic raising and lowering operators, and that's how you deduce the set states. So A and B are some indices which go over 1 and 2. So there's 2 C's and 2 C twiddles, and they're Hermitian conjugates, so they're 8 supercharges, just like there are 8 supercharges here. Okay, this thing which I've done for n equals 2 is very general. It can be done for any supersymmetry algebra. They can always be put in the form of this sort of creation and annihilation operator algebra for fermions. So this fact, since, let's say, take A equal to B here. Since the anti-commutator of any operator with its Hermitian conjugate is a positive operator, right, acting on taking the norm of any state, its expectation value in any state is just going to be the norm of something squared. It has to be positive. So what we learn is that since this is positive, the right-hand sides must be positive. So in particular, this guy must be positive. And that can only be positive or non-negative, I guess I should say, if m is greater than or equal to z. That's where it comes from. It just follows exactly from the algebra, and that's this bound. This bound is called the BPS bound for historical reasons. But in the supersymmetric context, it just follows straight from the algebra. And then if the bound is saturated, if m is equal to z, then we say that a state for which this is true is called a BPS state. Then you can see that these guys are zero, and these guys aren't. So if you do the representation theory here, take that state and think of the C's as the annihilation operators, then these would be the creation operators. But because these guys are zero on the state, you also have to consider these guys to be as annihilation operators. So the general multiplet on such a BPS state would be this guy, and then you'd get two more states by raising it with these guys, and then one more state by raising it twice, C1 dagger, C2 dagger. So the whole supermultiplet of this state has only four states in it, okay? So it's half the size of, if m did not equal z, both of these things would be non-zero, and this you'd also could have raising operators with this guy. So this is why states which satisfy the BPS bound are in so-called short multiplets, and they'll play an important role in just a second. The other thing to say about these states is z is some quantity. It's a scalar charge in the theory, some conserved charge in the theory. So if, you know, well, whatever it is, it's just some conserved charge in the theory. It could be like the electric charge of the particles. You'd have to figure it out in a given theory what actually z is in a given field theory realization of this algebra, but it's some conserved charge. So if you imagine that you had a state that was decaying into two other states, call them 1, 2, and 3, right? Then this one has, a charge z1, this one has charge z2, and this one has charge z3. Conservation of this charge says that these charges have to be conserved. On the other hand, there's something called the triangle inequality that says that this guy is always less than or equal to the sum of those two, okay? So if there are BPS, if this guy was BPS, this would say its mass would have to be less than or equal to the masses of the things that it's, the sum of the masses of the things that it's decaying into. In the generic case, if the phases didn't line up, it would be strictly less than, and this decay product would be disallowed. This is what gives rise to the stability of BPS particles. Okay? Now, there can be special cases when things line up, and then it just becomes marginally unstable. There's zero phase space, but it could, in principle, decay like this. To understand when or if that happens, you have to look at, again, the details of a specific realization. The other thing is the stability of if a state is BPS saturated, then imagine you start changing parameters in your theory. So now you're changing your theory. I'm not talking about a physical decay process. The fact that it's in a short multiplet, and if you slowly change the parameters, means that it's going to stay in a short multiplet because the dimension of the Hilbert space can't jump discontinuously. Actually, you say, well, Hilbert spaces are infinite dimensional. The point is that we can restrict ourselves to a finite dimensional Hilbert space by going to a sectors with certain charges. So if it's a massive state, look at all particle states. Go to the rest frame of those states, look at all particle states with a given energy, that is to say mass, and so forth. So they're in short multiplets. As you change the parameter continuously, this is just a finite dimensional set of states. Now, of course, you could say, well, couldn't there be something like level matching where some other, you just combine with some other multi-particle states? That would be precisely when this inequality becomes saturated. So it's possible that you can have decays of BPS states. And so there, it's not always true that under deformations of parameters that necessarily your BPS states will always remain BPS. But I mean, well, that's not quite right. What happens, what you could have is you could have boundaries across which you could change from one BPS state. You could exchange them for other BPS states, so to speak. So these are some subtleties of it. But especially with more supersymmetry, like if you talk about half BPS states in n equals 4 supersymmetric theories, then you're never in this situation where there's inequality. It turns out that the phases never match up. And so that you have strict stability of BPS states. And if something's BPS saturated at one value of, say, the coupling, it's going to be BPS saturated at any value of the coupling. OK, so that was more or less just an aside on BPS charges. I guess, oh, the last thing to say is that if you're looking for infrared effective actions, trying to understand what happens in the infrared in the theory, an infrared effective action is an effective action at an arbitrarily low mass scale. So you're going to take it below any finite mass scale in the theory. So any massive particles, any particles with any charge at all under the central charge, necessarily are massive particles, right? So when you go to an infrared effective action, you're going to be integrating out anything with a non-zero central charge. So in the infrared, you can simply turn off the central charge as far as we're concerned. Okay. For that reason, you'll see in lots of discussions people talking about extended N supersymmetry algebras without ever mentioning the central charge. And unless they're making a mistake, the reason they're doing it is usually something like this. What's that? This is for every state in the theory. If there's a massless particle, it must be neutral under this charge. It must have z equals 0. Otherwise, it's not cannot be massless. OK, good. If I didn't give you the details of rearranging the algebra in this form. Oh, I see. You're absolutely right. But it, nevertheless, it's true. I have to. What you do when if a particle is massless is now you go. We'll pick a different frame. We'll pick a frame in which, say, the first component is e and the second component is minus e. Again, just the way you would do find the particle representations of the supersymmetry algebra for massless particles. No, absolutely not. Yeah, all massless particles have zero central charge, but they need not be BPS states. They can be massive particles, and that is to say, here that you can't just tell from this inequality anymore. You have to ask whether they are in short or long multiplets. Okay. So much for this. For our purposes, all we want to know is what are the field representations of n equals 2 supersymmetry. And I'm not going to go into a lot of details about that. But just to tell you that as long as we're interested in spins less than or equal to 1, there are hypermultiplets. And in terms of n equals 1 language, that is a chiral superfield plus call it 1. I'm sorry, it's just 2 chiral superfields. I don't know why I said chi bar there. Let me actually use this notation. It's like Q and Q twiddle. I'll make it a little more precise in a second. And then there are vector multiplets in n equals 2, which in terms of n equals, this is, in other words, their n equals 1 superfield content. It is going to be a chiral superfield, phi, plus a vector superfield, W alpha. Okay. No, two Qs is all I meant to say. They are, when you couple them to gauge theories, well, these guys are vector bosons, so they're always in the adjoint representation of the gauge group. If I chose this guy to be in the representation R, it will turn out that the other guy has to be in the complex conjugate representation. So the hypermultiplets always appear in net real representations of the gauge group. Now, actually, when one of them is already in a real representation by itself, there's actually no, it's consistent, actually, with n equals 2 to just couple in a half, what's called a half hypermultiplet. It's really the smallest representation when Q is in a real representation, real or pseudo-real. But then, of course, there are other constraints from the Z2 anomaly. But anyway, let's not get into that. We'll be dealing with SUNC. So actually, let me get rid of this now. And let's talk now about classical super QCD. So I'll write down the Lagrangian just for definiteness. We're not really going to use it, but you might as well see how it goes, just to see that in n equals 1 language, it's nothing mysterious. It's what we've been talking about all along. You put the kinetic terms for the Qs in your Q twiddles. Now you also need to put, of course, a kinetic term for these phis. I'm dropping indices. We'll talk about them later. Now you can put on the gauge kinetic term, or the generalized superpotential terms. Let's see what we have to write down here. Well, this is the usual one we write down now. So far, it looks just like sort of the minimal n equals 2 theory you would write down. But then n equals 2 supersymmetry says that there's a superpotential term that you have to write down in this case. There is, if I took, if a field and its complex conjugate can always be coupled in a singlet to the adjoint representation, that's just a group theory fact. In the case of super QCD, where if I took the gauge group to be SUNC and I had NF of these guys, these in the fundamental and anti-fundamental, then this would be fundamental adjoint anti-fundamental, and you get that just by contracting indices. Okay. There's another relevant term that I, or you know, renormalizable term that I could add here, which is this guy. Here I put in the flavor indices. This would be a mass term, a bare mass term for the hypermultiplets. And not just, in n equals 1, you could put an arbitrary, plus, of course, complex conjugate of this whole thing. In n equals 1, you could put an arbitrary m, but from n equals 2 supersymmetry, there's a constraint on the m's. Namely, the thought of thinking of this as a matrix, it commutes with its Hermitian conjugate. Okay? It's a constraint on the mass, the allowed mass matrices. And so this is what we mean by n equals 2 super QCD. Okay? Thank you. Yes. No, go ahead. Yes, but it involves, well, the part for the, just for the vector superfields itself has a very formulation which is very similar to n equals 1 superspace, but it fails to work for for the hypermultiplets. To include the hypermultiplets, you have to go to something called harmonic superspace. And it's a little more complicated than n equals 1 superspace, but it works just as well. Anyway, this is not the place to go into it, but I'd be happy to talk to you about it afterwards. Okay, so this is our starting point. So now let's solve this theory classically. By solve, I mean let's let's solve the F and D term equations. There will, and for the moment, let's just forget the M's, okay? We can always turn them on, though, with no problem. This gives rise to some F term equations, and then the fact that we've coupled everything through the gauge fields give rise to the usual D term equations. Now, remember what I said this morning, solving the D term constraints is just the same as saying writing down all gauge invariant combinations, holomorphic gauge invariant combinations of Q, Q twiddle, and phi. Unfortunately, now there are many that you can write down. Okay? This is aided a little bit by the F term equations. If I took, say, the derivative of the superpotential with respect to Q and set it equal to zero, I get this sort of equation. And if I took it with respect to Q twiddle, I would get this sort of equation. So that kind of tells me if I turned on a generic VEV for the phis, then I'll be forced, essentially, to set all the Q VEVs to zero, and vice versa. If I turn on generic VEVs for the hypermultiplets, I'm forced to set the vector multiplet VEV to zero. Okay? So this tells me that even classically, there'll be a sort of separation into different branches of the moduli space. So let's give them a name. One branch is called the Coulomb branch. And I'll just call that CB from now on. And that's what we'll be focusing on. And that's the branch in which phi is non-zero, but the VEVs of the Qs and the Q twiddles turn out to be zero. This is just classically. And if you give an adjoint scalar a VEV, the way the Higgs mechanism works, this is just a classical fact, is that, let's talk about the SUNC gauge group. For a generic VEV, you break the SUNC down to the maximal U1 subgroup. In fact, this is true for any group, could be any group here. It will be broken down to the maximal U1 subgroup. So R, in this case, which is NC minus 1, is the rank of the gauge group. So if I just put the gauge group G here, okay? That's the physics, the classical physics, at least, on the Coulomb branch. What we'll be left with, then, are R light, massless U1 vector multiplets. And they will have, of course, associated with them these R complex scalars as the lowest components. So this moduli space is just going to be, so let me call this the Coulomb branch moduli space is just going to be, more or less, at least locally, an R complex dimensional space. I should actually tell you what then are the, I should say that's what? That should be, I should be able to give you a basis of gauge invariants made just out of the phis that would span this space. So those are easy to write down. I'll just do this for SUNC. The actual formulas would be different for different groups. For SUNC, what gauge invariants can I make out of phi? Well, I can contract their indices. I can take phi to the n and then trace it, and that will make a gauge invariant. I can't take trace of phi just by itself because this is SUNC, so the adjoint is traceless. But trace of phi squared would be non-zero. I can call this U1, just to give a name for it. I could take trace of phi cubed. That would be U2, dot, dot, dot. And then I certainly can go trace of phi to the n, c. That would be UNC minus 1, or UR. Those are our R complex coordinates on the Coulomb branch. You could say I could take trace of phi to the NC plus 1. But this phi is just an NC by NC matrix. And the traces, or the products, no, the traces, I should say, of a NC by N, of more than NC factors of an NC by NC matrix can always be rewritten as a polynomial in the traces of lower factors. Okay? This is just an identity from algebra. If it's unfamiliar for you, I suggest just playing around with 2x2 and 3x3 matrices to see that it's true. So this is the full set of independent generators of gauge invariants. So this is our picture of the Coulomb branch. Let's do the same sort of thing for the, well, Now there's another branch, which is much more complicated to describe, unfortunately. And this would be called the Higgs branch. Oh, and I should say where the name comes from. It's called Coulomb branch because of this classical physics that there's an unbroken U1 gauge theories, like which evinces, in other words, the Coulomb law at low energies. The Higgs branch is where we give non-zero vevs to the Qs or the Q twiddles, but zero vevs to the scalar and the vector supermultiplet. Here, the typical Higgs mechanism is that the gauge group is typically completely Higgs, and that's why we call it the Higgs branch. And the gauge invariance would be all the gauge invariance we can make out of Q and Q twiddle now, which you know, those are the mesons and the baryons, but they have all sorts of relations among them, so it can be some complicated space. But also modulo, there's another F-term equation. When I take the F derivative here, I get a relation on Q and Q twiddle. That simplifies things somewhat, but it's still, even classically, it's a complicated combinatoric problem to describe this branch. It turns out that the Higgs branch is always a 2n complex dimensional, or 4n real dimensional space, and it has a certain geometry, which I'll mention later. Okay. And then, of course, there might be special directions or submanifolds in which I only give vevs in some directions to the phis and other directions in the Qs such that this relation is satisfied. And then I have a sort of a mixed branch where I turn both on. So there's also a mixed branch, which locally just looks like a kind of a direct product of the subspace of the Higgs branch and the subspace of the Coulomb branch. So I won't go into the details. Let me just draw a cartoon then so that you have something to think about. This is the Coulomb branch, and it goes like locally, like C in our dimensional complex space. And there could be a special point. This is like the origin classically, where out of which there's a perpendicular direction which I can turn on. So this is where there's Higgs bevs. Vector bevs. And now I could turn on in this direction the Q bevs. And this is some other space. This is meant to be just orthogonal to this one. So this would be the Higgs branch. And this is a 4n real dimensional space. And typically it does, like I've drawn it here, have sort of a singularity where it meets the Coulomb branch. And in fact, it has a kind of a cone-like structure. And there could be subspaces in which a lower dimensional Higgs branch goes up, and that I can move along this direction in the Qs and at the same time in this direction in the phis. And this gives some other type of subspace here. And this would be a mixed branch. And all of this is a cartoon because I tried to draw it in three real dimensions, but it's really a higher dimensional complex space, and it can be a very elaborate set of intersections and so forth. Yes? Well, there may be some global symmetries in the theory. What you're talking about is not a, oh, well, I see. When you break down to, yes, absolutely. That there's actually, in this way of writing it, if I chose specific basis to describe what are the U1s, how they're embedded in the original gauge group, under this Higgsing, there's a part of the gauge symmetry which is left unbroken, which is the vial subgroup, the discrete vial subgroup of the gauge group. And that's part of the gauge symmetry. And like you say, it has to be modded out. This procedure of making gauge invariants does this automatically. And these gauge invariants, these coordinates, are automatically completely gauge invariant. And so they automatically have taken into account this symmetry on this leftover bit of the gauge symmetry. Yeah. This is supposed to be 2n. I haven't told you what n is, because it's a complicated thing to calculate. Okay? It depends on nc and nf and, you know, figuring out no, it's not that complicated to calculate just the dimension, but anyway. So, good. So now we have a picture of the classical moduli space. So the next thing to do is to look at effective actions. We've seen that classically, the generic theory at least on the Coulomb branch was a U1 theory. So all it had was massless vector U1 vector multiplets, or the typical direction was moving up here, let's say on the Higgs branch, and this was just the light degrees of the massless degrees of theorems are massless neutral hypermultiplets, right? They can't be charged hypermultiplets because they're getting a VeV. If a charged hypermultiplet gets a VeV, then it gets Higgs and would be massive. So what we should be interested in is we want to try to say write down the effective action in the infrared, and it should be made out of the U1 vector multiplets and neutral hypermultiplets. Try to write down the most general action that's allowed by n=2 supersymmetry, meaning we're assuming that n=2 supersymmetry is not broken dynamically, and then we'll have some form of the action, and we'll be able to deduce some selection rules, just the way we've done for the n=1 theory. This is making an assumption that these are sort of the right degrees of freedom to be using in the infrared, but it's a good assumption for the same reasons as we saw before. Here we have a moduli space, and if we go far out, go to large VeVs, we're Higgsing a strongly coupled theory at a high scale, asymptotically free theory at a high scale, so it's becoming weakly coupled. So you really believe this description, at least asymptotically far out on the Coulomb branch, or asymptotically far out on the Higgs branch. So it's a good guess to try to use these classical degrees of freedom in the infrared. So anyway, let's just write down the most general n=2 action, just keeping the leading terms in a derivative expansion, in other words, like the kinetic and potential type terms, that we can write down, compatible with n=2 supersymmetry. And let's see, so let me call these massless neutral hypers in the low energy theory, let me call them Q and Q twiddle in terms of n=1. And the vectors, changing the notation a little bit, I'll call them A and what else do I call them? And W, little w or something like this, little w alpha. So this is the n=1 vector. And instead of calling it phi or little phi, I'm going to call it A just so we don't get confused. Okay? So these are just a renaming of the vector and hypermultiplets. And then the infrared, the effective action here, has the following form somewhat heuristically. I'll give a little more detail as we go along. It has some sort of Kähler potential that I can write down for the hypers. And so it's going to be a function of the Qs and Q twiddles and Q bars and Q twiddle bars. And there will also be a Kähler potential for the vectors, which will be a function of the A's and the A bars. Let's say I have a whole bunch of these vectors, so I'm going to put some indices I on the vectors. And then there will be the generalized generalized superpotential type terms. And for these guys, you can have some sort of generalized coupling that depends holomorphically on the A's times the WI dot WJ plus its complex conjugate. And that's it. These are all the up to two derivative terms that are allowed by n=2 supersymmetry for these fields. So maybe a few questions. What happened to this term? This term vanishes because this term only exists if the Qs are charged under the gauge group. That is to say, if they're indices to contract, so to speak, there are none. Right here, this is a U1 gauge theory, and these are neutral hypermultiplets, so there is no such term. Okay? That's about it. No other terms are allowed. Okay? The forms of the Kähler potentials is constrained, and I'll tell you a little bit about those as well. But there are some immediate, just from what I've written down here, there are some immediate deductions we can make. First of all, there were no superpotential terms for the Q's or the A's that I wrote down. So no potential is allowed to be generated. Which implies that the Coulomb branch and the Higgs branch that we found classically are not lifted quantum mechanically. Okay? We cannot generate a quantum correction. It's just not allowed to generate a potential when you have n equals 2 supersymmetry for these fields. Yep. Are you asking why can't I have terms here which mix the two in the Kähler potential? Ah, they're not classically. So I was writing down, I could certainly write down an effective action for hypers charged under the U1s. That would be fine. But I was assuming that they were neutral under the U1s. Why? Because on the classical moduli space, the generic points on the classical moduli space, all the hypers, you know, if you're away from points like this, are neutral because they're getting VEVs. And if it was a charged scalar getting a VEV, it will get a mass. So it can only be on special points where they could be massless. Okay? So again, I'm looking at the generic, if you like, vacuum. We'll see examples of special places where things become massless and so forth. Charged things become massless. Yeah. Under the U1 gauge symmetry. You could ask that. I have to make a guess to start. I'm making a guess as to, at least at the generic vacuum, what the low energy degrees of freedom are going to be. We will see. This is on the Coulomb branch, so these are the BEVs of vectors, actually, vector multiplets. Over here, we would have some hypers, which would be like mesons and baryon type things. I'm just making this assumption. It's going to be good generically. It will break down at special points. Those will be the interesting points where we find new light degrees of freedom. Okay, but you know we have this whole moduli space. If we can get it almost everywhere, then that will give us a tool for figuring out what's happening at its singularities. That's kind of the game that we're playing. The next thing was that I wrote here that I didn't write any term in the Kähler potential which had both Q's and A's in it. Okay? So that was intentional. This is a result of n equals 2 supersymmetry. I'm just quoting this for you. I'm not deriving it for you. But that's very important. It means that the Kähler, the Higgs and the vector Coulomb branches don't mix in some sense. Well, to put it more clearly, that I can't get quantum corrections to the metric on the Higgs branch from the VEVs of Coulomb branch fields. So it doesn't matter where I am on the Higgs branch. It's not where this thing is sticking out on the Higgs branch is not going to vary like this. So in the mixed branches in particular, as I change a Coulomb VEV, the Higgs branch sticking above it is going to be the same no matter where I am along this line. So it will be just, in other words, a direct product of the Higgs-type space and the Coulomb space. Another point is that the strong coupling scale, or the gauge coupling tau, or equivalently the strong coupling scale of this theory, entered in a term in the generalized kinetic term the same way that VEVs of the vectors enter. So if I'm looking at a low energy effective action, it enters the way the lowest component of a vector superfield enters. So any place I see an A, I can also put a lambda. So the low energy effective coupling, U1 couplings, can depend holomorphically on lambda. And the Kähler potential here could just depend generally on lambda. But lambda is like the lowest component of a vector multiplet, so it will not appear here. This is what controls the quantum corrections in this theory, right? When I turn it off, it becomes the free theory in which nothing happens quantum mechanically. So what this is telling us is that the geometry of the Higgs branch doesn't get any quantum corrections. It doesn't matter how I dial up or change the coupling. It's going to have the same value as I found classically. So the Higgs branches get no quantum corrections. For this reason, they're somewhat uninteresting in the sense that you could compute them just classically, even though computing them classically might be difficult in practice. This is not true, though, of course, for the Coulomb branch. The Coulomb branch can get quantum corrections. And so we'll focus on the Coulomb branch. We'll actually try to compute what these quantum corrections are. So here's here's the resulting picture. Let's redraw this diagram. And what sort of things can happen? The Coulomb branch, which I drew as this flat plane now, gets all sorts of quantum corrections, so it can have singularities and stuff in it. I don't know how to draw it. So this is the Coulomb branch with its quantum corrections. And where the Higgs branch meets the Coulomb branch could get quantum corrections. But then the Higgs branches sticking off from it remain, this is supposed to be the same curve, the same. So this would be the mixed branch. And every fiber, so to speak, above the Coulomb branch, every Higgs branch above the Coulomb branch is the same as it was classically. And maybe a Higgs branch comes off from here, and the form of this Higgs branch will be the same as the classical form of the Higgs branch here. So this is sort of a cartoon of the sort of quantum mechanical things that happen. We can see that it's really all determined by what happens, the quantum deformations of the Coulomb branch. And again, because no superpotential is generated, the Coulomb branch is not lifted. It's just quantum deformed, like we saw in the NF equals NC case in the N equals 1 super QCD. So the next thing I have to tell you about is some more details about what the restrictions on the form of the Kähler terms that we can have in N equals 2 supersymmetry. These aren't obvious, but you might guess that there are some restrictions because, after all, the A's are related to the W's by now N equals 2 supersymmetry. So there should be some relation between the effective couplings tau and the form of K. And I'll write that down in a second. Likewise, and less obviously, there are also special restrictions on the form of the Kähler potential for Q's. These restrictions imply that the geometry of the Higgs branches form what are called hyper-Kähler manifolds. And I don't know if Paul Aspinwall mentioned these things, but it's a certain type of complex geometry. And that's what the Higgs branches satisfy. Again, since they don't, in the gauge theory case here, since they don't get quantum corrections, they're not so interesting. The gravitational sort of analog of this, they can get quantum corrections, and then there's more interesting things to say in certain cases. So let's move on to the Coulomb branch and see what geometry we get here. So I'll rewrite, let me just say it as follows. If I wrote this guy out in components, it would includes for the scalar components of the A's, the following term: the imaginary part of tau ij of A times the kinetic term for A. Okay? That's to say, this isn't just a generic Kähler term. It has a very special form. It looks like a kinetic term, and it has a mixing of AI with AJ, which is governed by the imaginary part of the couplings tau IJ, which appear in the kinetic term for the W's, as I said, related, because they're related by N equals 2 supersymmetry. And furthermore, there's one further constraint, which is that Let me write it like this. Let's write it like this. I don't know if I've messed this up too badly. This is the anti-symmetrized derivative on I and j of tau jk with respect to I, where by del sub I mean the derivative with respect to ai. Okay? So I'll call this the integrability condition. This is also follows from n equals 2 supersymmetry. I'm just quoting these results here. They come from just playing around. These are, after all, classical Lagrangians. You just play around with them with n equals 2 supersymmetry. If you know about harmonic superspace, then these things are very simple to come up. These constraints are simple to read off. I should mention a couple of other constraints that are also implicit in all of this. First of all, tau ij appears in front of wi dot wj, which is symmetric on I and j. So we can always take tau ij to be symmetric. And it appears in the, well, either on either term, the imaginary part appears as a coefficient for the kinetic term. So for unitarity, we need that as a symmetric real matrix, the imaginary part of tau ij has to be a positive matrix. All its eigenvalues have to be positive. Okay? So this set of conditions specifies for, this effective metric on the Coulomb branch, subject to these conditions, specifies some kind of complex geometry. And it's called rigid special Taylor geometry. Rigid has to do with the fact that we're talking about gauge theories. If we're talking about gravitational theories, the conditions loosened a little bit, and it's just called special Taylor geometries. But in the gauge theory context, it's called rigid special Taylor geometry. I'll just call this RSK for short. So the idea now is going to say, using these constraints, these selection rules from n equals 2 supersymmetry, can we figure out what the low energy, what the tau, these effective tau ij's are, in other words, solve for this rigid special Taylor geometry, given the ultraviolet information, which is, some matter content in some gauge group, right, and some strong coupling scale, lambda. So Seiberg and Witten wrote two long papers on this subject 10 years ago, 11 years ago. And I'm going to try to give you a sort of a quick way of getting their results, where you don't have to do a lot of work, just sort of counting on your fingers. But it will take a little mathematical preparation, in the sense that we're going to have to take this formulation of rigid special Taylor geometry, which is what we get just from the action, and reformulate it in a little more mathematically sophisticated way. As preparation for this, there's one piece of physics we have to mention, which is electromagnetic duality. This is a redundancy in the description of low energy, I'll say, put that in there, low energy U1 actions. It has nothing to do with supersymmetry at all. It has to do with electromagnetism. Well, really, quantum electromagnetism, because one bit of quantum mechanics comes in here. And it's just the redundancy in that you know of in Maxwell's equations, that I can everywhere replace the electric field with the magnetic field if I also replace the magnetic field with minus the electric field. And the vacuum Maxwell's equations, the Maxwell's equations in which there's no charged matter, right, remain the same. Okay? So what we're talking about here on the Coulomb branch is a low energy U1 theory with no charged matter. So we're in the same boat as electromagnetism. We just have R copies of it, so to speak. So this is a redundancy. I don't know what I mean by the electric and the magnetic field. I can rename them at will. Now, there's something that keeps track, though, of the fact that there were charged particles in our theory, and that's the values of wherever they are. That's the values here. Well, I didn't want to do them here. Here, that's the values of the effective U1 couplings. This tau ij matrix. If there was just a single U1, we'd get rid of the ij indices, and it would just be some matrix tau. Not matrix, it's just a complex number tau. It would be just the effective coupling of this U1 theory, not to be confused with the ultraviolet coupling tau. What does that mean? After all, this is a free theory with no charged particles. What different? If it's a free theory, why can't I set the coupling to anything I like? Well, you could ask yourselves the same question in QED. We measure the electric coupling, alpha, 1 over 137. What does that mean, that it has this value, 1 over 137? Well, the point is, that's how it couples. That tells you the strength that it couples to whatever the lightest charged particle in the theory is, which happens to be the electron in our universe. And so the point is simply that the coupling above the mass of the electron, the coupling is no longer 1 over 137. It runs with scale, just like all the usual couplings in quantum field theory run. But below the scale of the electron mass, there are no other charged particles to run in the loops, and it's just a constant. So what the low energy coupling reads off is the value of the coupling of the U1 field at the mass of the lightest charged particle. So it tells you how strongly you couple to some massive sources in the theory, okay? So if I'm going to include as classical or background sources in my theory some electric and magnetic charges, if I'm going to interchange my electric and magnetic fields, I'll also have to interchange what I mean by electric and magnetic charges. So this told me that the strength of the coupling to electric charges, what was the strength of the coupling to magnetic charges? Because since I'm interchanging them, I have to reverse the two. Well, if tau gives me the strength of coupling to the electric charges, minus 1 over tau is the coupling to magnetic charges, which, forgetting how the theta angle dependence, that's just telling us that if G was is the strength of the coupling to electric charges, 1 over G is the strength of the coupling to magnetic charges. And this follows from quantum mechanics, from Dirac quantization, okay? Which I hope you've seen somewhat before. So putting together with the fact that shifting the theta angle by 2 pi doesn't change the physics, so that there's also a redundancy in the description of the physics under shifts of theta of tau by 1. Together, these two groups generate a group of transformations called Möbius transformations or fractional linear transformations, where this thought of as a matrix A, B, C, D is an element of SL2Z. That is to say, it's just an integer determinant 1 matrix. Okay? I've done all this for one U1 factor. If you have R U1 factors, what happens? Well, this stays the same, but now A, B, C, D becomes an element of integer value 2R by 2R symplectic matrices. So A, B, C, D are now here interpreted as R by R blocks. And tau, after all, is then, in this case, it has now two indices running from 1 to R, so it's a symmetric R by R complex matrix. Okay? That's electric magnetic duality, and it's just the redundancy in my description. I can do this just by renaming what I'm deciding to call electric and magnetic in my theory, essentially. Okay. This will turn out to be an important component of the whole story. I guess one other thing that I'm going to have to say is that let's look at a consequence of this integrability condition. This condition says that at least locally, I can write tau ij as the derivative of some function, call it bi, with respect to my fields aj. Remember, this derivative here was the derivative with respect to a. right? So this is just the this is just a local integrability condition for this equation. So it says locally there exists some other functions of the A's, some other, if you like, coordinates on my Coulomb branch, such that this is true. And if these are this set of coordinates, AJ and the BIs, they also transform. They transform like a vector under this this symmetry, if I want to preserve the form of the low energy action. And these are called special coordinates. On the Coulomb branch. They're called special coordinates because if I made a general field redefinition on my scalars, I would not, you can easily check it for yourself, preserve this special form of the low energy effective action. It would mix it up and it wouldn't, you would no longer have imaginary part of tau ij. So what this is saying, and part of the reason why this isn't a good, this isn't the best description of what we mean by rigid special Kähler geometry, is it says rigid special Kähler geometry is a certain complex geometry in which there exists a coordinate system such that you can write things in this way. And that's always very hard to deal with. This coordinate system is these special coordinates, okay? It's, in some sense, it's the coordinates that are picked out by n equals 2 supersymmetry. You pick the right coordinates, A, such that those are the ones which are linear related by n equals 2 supersymmetry to the U1 coordinates. Okay. Good. So with this, these facts under our belts, let's now talk about rigid special Kähler geometry. What I want to do is explain to you, in hopefully not too complicated terms, how we take this data, these set of rules on the taus, and rewrite them in a sort of coordinate independent way. And we get a very beautiful description of the geometry. So this appears, unfortunately, in a kind of an abbreviated way in a paper by Donaghy and Witten from a while ago. It's 9510101. Okay, the beginning sections of this paper talks about this reformulation of rigid special Kähler geometry. There are many discussions of rigid special Kähler geometry in the literature. So let me collect some of those formulas here and just say the vector multiplet, this is the bosonic part of the U1 low energy effective action, so can be written in this way, just collecting that stuff there. Tau ij, which is a holomorphic function of the A's, times del AI dot del bar AJ plus Fi mu nu contracted with Fj mu nu, right? Okay, and well, since I'm going to erase it later, let me copy this off over again. This is equal to zero. Tau ij is tau ji, and imaginary part of tau ij is positive. Okay, this summarizes for us what rigid special Kähler geometry is. Now we just want to reformulate this data in some way. So here's the idea. To every point on the Coulomb branch, so I'll label my points on the Coulomb branch by some good global complex coordinates, which I'll just call U. These are our set of RU coordinates. So I have my Coulomb branch here, and it has some coordinates U. So at any point on the Coulomb branch, a point with a coordinate u, let me associate an object, which is going to be a torus, okay? And I'll call this torus T of u, which is to tell me that this is a fiber bundle, right? As I change u, I have this associated torus changes, and it changes in a way that's going to be holomorphic in u, okay? And now I have to tell you something about this torus. But before I do that, the physical intuition for what we're doing here is that we're just the total space here is going to be the fiber bundle for the gauge group, a U1 gauge group. Now, you usually think of fiber bundles for a U1 gauge group as just circle bundles, but once we're in, have supersymmetry in four dimensions, the gauge group is really complexified, as maybe it was pointed out to you in Eric's lectures. And so the natural thing is to have a torus bundle. So I won't say any more. It's just easier now to just tell you what this torus is. It is an R complex dimensional torus. That's to say, it's a 2R real dimensional torus, right? Two directions for every U1 factor. And so let me describe it in terms of R real coordinate, 2R real coordinates, which I'll call, what will I call them? XI and YI. So I as usual goes to 1 to R. These are X and I are real. And I can make a torus by giving periodic identifications on these guys. And since I'm just choosing coordinates to describe it, I can choose them anywhere I like. And the identification I'm going to do is make this a completely square torus. Okay, good. So I've just made a square, so to speak, 2R real dimensional torus. But I want to think of it as an R complex dimensional torus, so I have to specify some complex coordinates on this torus, a complex structure, if you like. I just have to tell you what are the complex combinations of X and Y. So here's my complex coordinate, ZI, and I'll call it XI plus tau IJ YJ summed over the J's. So I'm going to use my tau, which depends holomorphically on my coordinates on my Coulomb branch, to assign my complex structure on this torus. So this makes this into a complex torus. Actually, to be completely general, I'm allowed to put an arbitrary integer or set of integers, not quite arbitrary, set of integers, ni, in front of x, no sum here. This is when the torus is not principally polarized, as they say. So this is almost never discussed in the literature, but there's some interesting physics involved in it. But for the moment, let's just set it equal to 1. Okay. I just wanted to point that out so that you might keep it in mind if you ever work in the area. So let's see. Of course, the tau I'm using here is the tau we had here. So it's a tau that has positive definite imaginary part and is symmetric. Okay. With those properties, so far we haven't used the integrability properties, just these properties, there's a natural two form that I can write down on this torus. Yes? I'm sorry? Yeah. The curly Fs are just the field strengths, the self-dual field strengths. So it's F mu nu made out of the gauge fields plus, I guess it's a 1/2 in front of the whole thing, plus I F mu nu twiddle. That would be the self-dual in quotes mean. It's complex in four-dimensional Minkowski space field strength. This is the thing which enters into supersymmetric vector multiplets in four dimensions. And it's kind of sort of the reason why it's a sort of a reflection of the fact that the gauge group is complexified. But in any case. So there is a natural, in this construction, two form that I can write down. And you can easily check that it has a bunch of nice properties. It's closed. It's integral. Well, that it's integral is obvious because integral means that its periods around any cycles are integer valued on the torus. It's positive, which is also obvious in this way of writing it. And also it's a 1-1 form. which is less obvious, that involves rewriting it in terms of z's and z-bars and shows you that there's only a z-wedge z-bar piece and no z-z or z-bar z-bar piece, so it's a 1-1 form. If you have a complex torus with such a with such a form, this is called a Hodge form on the torus, or as more usually called a polarization in the physics literature, but also in the math literature. What did I want to say? Oh, and then there's this theorem that any complex torus with a Hodge form, well, there's two things that I want to say. One, a complex torus that has a Hodge form has a name, and it's called an abelian variety. So I'm just telling you what some words mean from math. But the import of this is that such a torus can always be described as the solution set of a set of polynomial equations in projective spaces, right? So it's something which has, in principle, an algebraic description. And when you find things which have algebraic descriptions, then you know you're in fairly good situation, because then you can actually calculate with these things. So that will play an important role. I want to say now that I can now throw away this whole construction and just say that T is not, because I'm trying to aim for a coordinate independent way of discussing these things. If I just have a complex r-dimensional torus with a Hodge form, then I can deduce what tau ij is. Okay? So let me turn this whole thing around and just say that rigid special Kähler geometry some CPN. It can be embedded algebraically in CPN for n large enough, and I forget what the bound on n is. Any compact? No, that's certainly not true. any analytic manifold. So this is a way of saying that telling us that these are the special subset, these are very special subset of all possible complex tori which are analytic. Right? So, okay. So I want to now, so with this construction, I wanted to show you how this construction is sort of inverted. So we just, what we're just thinking, we now want to say that rigid special Kähler geometries are this torus bundle, this holomorphic bundle of abelian varieties of dimension r over the Coulomb branch. And with an abelian variety has some Hodge form on it. And given this data, I'll show you how you find tau. And this, well, here's the prescription. Tau is given by the following formula. I'll kind of write it out in sections. Is given by some matrix formula where these BIK is defined as follows. It is an integral over some cycle on this torus of some form, one form. And similarly, the A JKs are given as an integral over some different cycle, alpha K, over the same one forms. So I have to tell you what all these the stuff in here are. The set omega K is any basis of holomorphic 1-0 forms on our torus. In this coordinate system, an obvious basis are these guys, right? DZ is a perfectly well-defined holomorphic 1-0 form on the thing. So it's here, it doesn't matter what basis you choose. There are, choose a basis, and it will this formula will work. In some sense, the choice of basis cancels out between these two guys. The only other thing I need to tell you then are how I choose these cycles, alpha and beta. So alpha and beta are one cycles. That is to say, they're a basis of the homology of the torus. So there's 2R of them corresponding to going around the torus in 2R different ways. And they're the cycles which sort of have the following sort of intersection matrix. The alpha cycles go around the handles of the torus, the cycles of the torus in one way, and the beta cycles are the ones that go around the torus in the other way. And this is just the higher dimensional version of that. So how do we say that? The way of computing, the invariant way of computing this intersection of cycles relative to T with the Hodge form is just to say that if you take the, I don't know what it's called, the cup product or something like this, the kind of the two cycle that's spanned by the two one cycles, and integrate the Hodge form over them, then it should give me delta ij, which is just telling me that the alpha cycles, and similarly, if I did it with an alpha I with an alpha j, it would give me zero, and a beta I with a beta j is zero. This is called a canonical basis of cycles. Okay? It's just a way of picking out some basis of the homology cycles. And then we can determine it. In these coordinates, the cycles are simply a cycle where all the x's and y's are constants except for one, which we go around this guy. That would be one, that would be the alpha I cycle. And the beta I cycle would be simply the cycle where we integrate y around one cycle, keeping all the other variables constant. Okay? It's maybe seems a little fancy, but it's just restating things which looked obvious in those flat coordinates in general coordinate invariant language. You might say, why don't we just stick with those flat coordinates that I introduced? And so I should have said early on that the problem is that to describe these flat coordinates, I need to know this function, tau of u. And it turns out that this function can be very complicated. Okay? In the simplest cases, it's given by elliptic integrals or generalized hypergeometric functions or something like this. And that's just in the simplest cases. After that, it's just, you know, analytically way out of control. But this allows us to get around that and not have to deal with the specific functional form of tau with respect to u. We can figure out the omegas and the alphas, and then we'll have some formulas like this, and at the end of the day, we can just stick them into a computer and numerically evaluate them if we want to. So that's the strategy. How am I doing on time? Okay. Okay. So far so good. We've encoded this part of the data and this part of the data, but we haven't encoded this piece. So I'm missing. There's still some extra condition on this geometry to capture the full rigid special Kähler geometry. But there's one other thing we want to say. We saw over here that we had some redundancy in our description under changes in tau by these SP2RZ transformations. And this is actually also automatically taken care of in this formulation, because if I think of the alphas and the beta cycles as a 2R component column vector, and I transform them in the homology, right, by a linear transformation to make a new basis of cycles of the homology, right, they will satisfy this same condition. So this new basis will also be a canonical basis as long as this transformation is an element of SP2RZ. So this definition of tau was actually automatically redundant up to the electric magnetic duality transformations, okay? Which is, so this fits perfectly. It exactly captures the same information as we had in that action over there. Okay, so I said we still need that integrability condition on tau. And so I'm just going to tell you what the answer there is. The integrability condition, so this condition, del I tau jk equals zero. Thank you very much. You're right. It's already symmetric on J and K, so this would vanish otherwise. Did I do it? I did it incorrectly here as well. Sorry. It's just anti-symmetrized on the first two. This condition is equivalent to the existence of a closed holomorphic 2-0 form, which I'll call omega, on the total space. The total space is not just the Coulomb branch, this is the Coulomb branch, remember, but the fiber bundle of these tori over the Coulomb branch. So this was R complex dimensional, the fibers are complex dimensional, so the total space is a 2R complex dimensional space. Actually, very closely related to a hyperkähler manifold, but that's another story. But in any case, so if such a thing exists, then following basically the calculus through, you find that the taus that are derived are going to automatically satisfy this. What is this omega in the in the special coordinates? Omega in the special coordinates is just the following. Oops, do I have my eyes in the wrong place, probably? It's just this thing. It's the two form made from these kind of flat complex coordinates on the fiber wedged with the corresponding special coordinate on the base. Okay. And again, you can check that this is invariant under electric magnetic duality transformations in the appropriate way. Maybe I should just say, for people who've seen some of this before, this is closely related to something called the Seiberg-Witten form. Because it's closed, right, so d omega is equal to 0, that implies that at least locally, that omega is is d of a one form on the total space. And then this one form, restricted to the fibers, is what's called, so this Seiberg-Witten one form just on the fiber tori turns out to be a mirror-morphic form called the Seiberg-Witten one form. And much of the discussion in the literature uses this guy instead of the more invariant object, omega. So, okay. So this has been this mathematical sort of detour. Let me just say one more. I guess there are a few more things to say before we start writing down solutions. I guess it's actually something to say about the existence of this holomorphic two form. Maybe a more convenient way of in actually solving for things, to show that a two form exists, you want to give some set of differential equations, which are the conditions for this thing to exist. That makes it easier to actually make progress in computing things. So the existence of this closed two-form omega is equivalent to existence of a basis of holomorphic one-forms on the fiber, which we called omega k, right? That, remember, they are going to vary holomorphically with u. So these are closed, non-exact holomorphic 1-0 forms on the fiber, such that their U dependence has to have, you know, you can see we're relating the fiber and the base in some way. So the U dependence is going to have to satisfy some conditions, and the appropriate differential equation that they satisfy is the following. Again, it takes the form of an integrability equation. So these, anyway. And, so this says that the anti-symmetrized derivative, the cross product, so to speak, of the omega k's is a total derivative along the fiber direction of some, this is some general mirror-morphic function on the total space, which is automatically anti-symmetrized on its two indices. And furthermore, this can't be any function, but it has to satisfy the following integrability condition. Okay? So these conditions are equivalent to the existence of omega. This is the more useful form. So, but in any case, for what I want to do next, in just a second, is to try to solve these conditions in the case when we just have a one complex dimensional Coulomb branch. So, that's the case when R is equal to 1 in my notation. So I and J, K, just run over the value 1. And so all of these conditions are empty, right? Because you can't anti-symmetrize on things with just, you just take one value. So these guys are automatically satisfied. There's always this 2-0 form exists. So it's actually a much simpler thing. All we have to do is just write down all fiber bundles of 2 tori of varying holomorphically over the complex plane. And this will give us the general solution to rigid special Kähler geometry, and therefore to the low energy effective actions for sort of rank 1 n equals 2 theories. So what are some rank 1 n equals 2 theories in the Lagrangian formulation? Well, the only rank 1 non-abelian gauge group that we have that could be asymptotically free is SU2. So this would be solving, you would think, the SU2 gauge theory. And you can ask, well, so which ones are asymptotically free? And there's a short list of asymptotically free or scale invariant, which would be the ones we'd typically be interested in. And there's a short list of six such theories. You can have an SU2 with 1 triplet hypermultiplet. That would be like the N equals 4 theory, actually. An SU2 with 4 doublet hypermultiplets. This is a purely n equals 2 scale invariant theory. And then, of course, I could have fewer, and it would be asymptotically free theory. So I could have 3, 2, 1, or 0. If there were no hypermultiplets, then it would be the SU2 Yang-Mills theory. So we're going to solve these. These theories were all solved at length in the 2 papers by Seiberg and Witten in the summer of 94. Okay? So I'm going to go ahead and do that in just a minute, and we'll see that we can do this. And if you're clever about it, you can do this with very little work. But there's a piece of an important piece of physics which I've just jumped over here, and I included it briefly in the notes. That is, we said that there was also another part of the algebra which was the central charge, and an important part of what Seiberg and Witten did is actually also gave us a formula for what the central charge was in terms of conserved charges in the theory. The conserved charges turn out to be the electric and magnetic charges of the low energy U1s, as well as possible conserved sort of quark number charges. Okay? So it's a whole other story, and it's an important part of the whole story, but I can give you the solutions without doing that. And for the sake of, given the shortness of time, I'll just skip over the discussion of the central charges. So, on to one-dimensional Coulomb branches. So, like I said, all we want to do is write down a holomorphically varying family of abelian varieties of rank 1, that's just to say 2 tori, over a complex plane, which I'll call the complex U-plane. So how would I write that down in formulas? Well, all I need to do is say I have a complex parameter U. Now it's just one variable. And for every U, I want to write down an equation describing a torus. Well, there's a famous, very simple equation which describes a torus. Which is the following equation. What is this? Y and X are some sort of auxiliary complex variables. I can be, we could be fancy and put this in a projective space, but let's just be a little more naive about it. So this is an equation in two complex variables, but it's one complex equation. So if I solve this equation, its graph, so to speak, will be a one complex dimensional surface. How can I think of this? I have a complex x-plane. And for every value of x, I can find a value of y. In fact, generically, I'll find two values of y. So we would call this the double cover of the x-plane. So if we think of it as a two-sheeted Riemann surface, will be, you can, this will be the double cover of the x-plane. But there are certain points, namely the zeros of this polynomial in x, where the right-hand side is zero, and therefore there's only one value of y, namely zero. So there's three points called the branch points, right, where it's zero. And then going around these branch points, if you start on one of the Riemann sheets, you go to the other, because there'll be a square root branch cut here. So I have to put little branch cuts between these, between pairs of these guys. One of these guys goes off to infinity, because there's really a branch point at infinity. So it's a double cover of the x-plane branched over three points plus infinity, if you like. If you put this on projective space, the point at infinity would be in there, and it would make everything compact. So we should think of it as two copies of the x-plane, and whenever you cross one of these cuts, you end up, you go to the other plane. And it's a torus. One, you can glue them together mentally, include the points at infinity, the point at infinity, and you'll see that it has a topology of a torus. Or maybe a slicker way of doing it is say, I just have to find two non-trivial homology cycles and then convince myself that there are bases of homology cycles. They're very easy to write down. This could be my alpha cycle, and I want one that intersects it. So let me do this cycle like this. But when I cross the cuts, it goes on to the other sheet, right? So this will be my beta cycle. And there are my two non-trivial cycles in my torus. Okay. Well, if I haven't convinced you, you should play around with it. This is called a Riemann surface. It's a torus in this case. It's the most general torus, in fact. We needed to know what a basis of holomorphic one-forms were on this space. Well, that takes a little bit of work, but it's not too hard. You can have some arbitrary function of u times dx over y. I'm not going to go through the math. It's trivial just to show that even though sometimes y's have zeros, this as a one-form on the Riemann surface, there are no poles of this one-form. It's holomorphic in u, and it never blows up. It's not mirror-morphic. Okay, this is the holomorphic one-form. There's only one, so it's the holomorphic one-form on the space. So we have all our ingredients now for describing our theory. Now we have all so you can say for arbitrary h, f, and g, we've given all the general solutions of the Seiberg-Witten theory of the n equals two low energy effective actions for rank one. So to explore this space a little better, what we should do is focus in on some physically interesting configurations. And the way to do that is to say, let's look for scale invariant solutions. Why? Because the general idea is if you have a scale invariant solution, that gives you some fixed point in the renormalization group flow of theories. And then I can find relevant operators, like mass operators or something, which flow me away from it, and I get to all the other theories in this way. That would be the general idea. So let's look for scale invariant. Solutions. Solutions means scale invariant curves and one-forms. So the idea is I'm going to assign a scaling dimension, a mass dimension, u in brackets to the variable u. And this is going to be the scaling as u scales to the origin. So as I go to a specific point on my, well, it's not this breadth, this space, on the space of u's, I want things to scale in some definite way. So And this simplifies this thing, because then I can pick out the leading, the lowest power of U in any given term, right? So I can replace all these guys, F and G here, by some constant times U to the N and U to the M. These will be the lowest powers of U. They will dominate the scaling behavior. And similarly, there's a lowest power here, but I actually can take advantage of the fact that I have a certain amount of redefinitions of variables and so forth. So I won't go into it, but you can scale this guy to 1 for convenience. It's just a matter of getting rid of certain redundancies in the variables. So we set omega to be this, and I have these guys. And in fact, if both alpha and beta were non-zero, I could choose one of them to be 1 via rescaling as well. We'll use that later. Turns out N and M have to be integers for physics to be single valued on the for this geometry to be single valued on the U plane. So that's given us by the sort of regularity of our description. So we now have cut it down to some unknown coefficients and some unknown integers. The integers, moreover, should be positive. We want, as U goes to 0, we want this thing to have some sort of scaling behavior. So we're going to, what happened in a scale invariant theory, as we go to the scale invariant point, we should have extra massless particles. That's what we mean by it. That's the signal of some new physics at the scale invariant point. So as U goes to 0, you expect to have some new light particles. And the way to get new light particles, and this is the part that I skipped, is to have these branch points collide, because then the length of the cycle that goes around a pair of branch points will go to 0. The length of the cycle, really not quite the length of the cycle, but the period of that Seiberg-Witten 1 form with respect to this cycle, is the formula that Seiberg and Witten figured out for the central charge. It's the thing that calculates masses, or at least the BPS, the lower bound on masses. So if you want extra states becoming massless, you're going to need the central charge to go to 0, and so you need these singularities, these pinching off of cycles on the Riemann surface. So I could have one pair pinch off and the other one not pinch off. That wouldn't be the maximal singularity. Those turn out not to be too interesting physically, but you can do it. I'm just not going to do it here. The maximal singularity is if all three of these guys went together at once. That meant both the alpha and the beta cycle pinch off at once. We get more massless particles. It turns out we get both electrically and magnetically charged particles becoming massless, and that's the sign of an interacting fixed point theory. If only one pair pinches off, we get what turns out to be their extra charged massless particles, but it's just a free theory, just in a sort of an abelian U1 theory. So that's why I want both of these guys to have positive powers, that is to say, not positive as opposed to 0, right? So they're not constants. Because now, as U goes to 0, both of these terms vanish. And so at the origin, we have x squared equals y cubed, all three zeros of this polynomial at the same point, in this case, x equals 0. OK, so I'm 5 minutes over, but I'm so close to the end that I hope you'll stick with me for 5 more minutes. So let's see. How can we do this? Let's assign now, let's just figure out what the scaling dimensions of all these variables have to be. We have, just for consistent scaling of this thing, we have twice the scaling dimension of y, should be 3 times the scaling dimension of x, should be n times the scaling dimension of u plus the scaling dimension of x, and that should be m times the scaling dimension of u. Okay, that, I'm just reading it off from demanding that each term here has the same scaling dimension. If one had a higher scaling dimension than the others, we would drop it because it wouldn't be dominating in the scaling limit, right? So it could be that one or the other of these coefficients is 0. We'll see that in a second. This isn't enough equations to figure out all the scaling dimensions, but we haven't normalized the scaling dimensions. Again, I need the formula for the central charge. I'll just write it for you here. I should have written it before. is that depending on the electric and magnetic charges tells you what cycle to integrate over, but the derivative of the central charge with respect to U just turns out to be the line integral of this holomorphic one form. So looking at that, remembering that this is the line integral of dx over y, and remembering that, well, what does this tell us? This tells me that the scaling dimension of the central charge minus the scaling dimension of U must be equal to the scaling dimension of x minus the scaling dimension of y. Just dimensional analysis of this equation, right? But the scaling dimension of the central charge is 1. That is to say, it has mass dimension 1. Remember, central charges measured masses. So now we have enough equations to determine the scaling dimensions, at least in terms of these parameters n and m. So let's just solve these equations. You can probably do it as fast as it takes me to write them down. We get the following answer. The scaling dimension of U is 4 over 4 minus n, or it's 6 over 6 minus m. Okay? And we said the scaling dimension of U has to be positive because we're scaling to U equals 0, right? Not to U equals infinity. So these are positive integers that satisfy this relation, right? So they're only a finite list of values of n and m, which gives you positive scaling dimensions. So here's the list. U, the scaling dimension of this operator in the low energy theory, so it's an anomalous dimension in some conformal field theory, and I'll write out for you what the resulting curve is. So the lowest solution is when U is 6/5, and then this is what the curve is, y squared equals x cubed plus U. That's all. In other words, that's the case when m is 1 and alpha is 0. So you drop, there's no solution for m consistent with this, so you drop this term, you just have this term. And then I can scale away beta by a rescaling of U and x and y. So let me just continue now and give you the whole list. 4/3, 3/2, 2, 3, 4, and 6. And then this guy is ux, u squared x plus u cubed. This is the one case where, this is for 2, this is the one case where I have both terms can balance, so they can both scale in the same way. So their relative coefficient matters, so that there is now an arbitrary dimensionless parameter in this model. Then the next one is u to the 4th, and then u cubed x, and then a u to the 5th. So this is the full list of maximal scale invariant solutions. The mathematicians in the audience will recognize this as the Kodaira classification of singularities of holomorphic families of tori, which is basically what we just did. Let's talk about this guy in particular. This guy, the dimension of U was 2. If it had been an SU2 theory, that would have been the canonical dimension of what we would have called U on the Coulomb branch, because phi was the canonical scalar field, so it should have had scaling dimension 2. So this one has it. And it has an exactly marginal operator, so this presumably is the scale invariant theory, SU2, with 4 doublets that I guess I wrote down over there. This is one where the beta function vanishes, so it's has an exactly marginal coupling, I'll call it tau. So this thing, y squared equals x cubed plus u squared x plus tau u cubed, is the Seiberg-Witten curve for the SU2 theory with 4 fundamentals, okay? What you would like to do is actually see how it also depends on the mass parameters for those 4 fundamentals. So I should do a mass deformation of this curve. I'll show you how you do that in just a second. And then you would have the full formula for the Seiberg-Witten curve. This is the thing that they derived in their paper. The interesting thing is that there are 6 other ones with sort of isolated fixed points, isolated in the sense that they don't have a marginal operator. So they don't have a weak coupling limit where I can associate it with a Lagrangian field theory. So these are some sort of non-Lagrangian field theories, you might conformal fixed points. It was discovered that these guys, these three theories, are sort of embedded in this theory if you take certain limits, turn on masses, and tune them in the appropriate way, and then you arrive at these conformal field theories. But these guys are not. And I'm out of time, so I'm not going to do the mass deformation. But the mass deformation just says add in all possible subleading terms that you could in here. Those mass parameters, you can read off those parameters, you can read off their mass dimensions. Those are just the what you call the adjoint Casimirs of whatever the global symmetry group of the theory is. And you can read off the mass deformations of this theory in this way. If you do that, and there's a little bit more technology, but you can identify the global symmetry groups of these theories. For this theory, you get SO8, and that's just right. It turns out that the global symmetry group of this theory with four doublets has an SO8 global symmetry group, so that's great. These ones have some other ones, U3, U2, and U1. The interesting guys are these guys. They turn out to have E6, E7, and E8 global symmetry groups. These are strange theories for which, up until now, no direct four-dimensional Lagrangian description has been found, or even a higher rank Lagrangian theory which flows down to these theories has not been found. But we're convinced that this isn't just an artifact of the mathematics in some sense. In other words, we didn't just find a rigid special Kähler geometry that has no corresponding field theory. In fact, we're convinced that these exist as conformal field theories in four dimensions through a string construction, where you can make a construction involving little string theories, if you like, in six-dimensional, some kind of exotic six-dimensional theory, and then by compactifying on torus, you can see it flows down to these theories. This gives a construction in string theory, if you believe string theory, or evidence for the existence of these conformal points in four dimensions. So I think I'll stop there.
You should have given this to me at the beginning, right?
No, it disappears very quickly because